So, tonight we come to the Tantra. And the word means something like thread or warp and woof, a weaving together of a chain, something spun, something connected. And that's a sense that is carried throughout the tantric tradition, which begins in the remote past and continues to this day. The Tantra is alive. It is before Hinduism, it is before Buddhism. It continues inside of Hinduism, inside of Buddhism. But we don't know where it begins. Those murky origins are, like so much in India, lost in history. Did not survive early documentation, if ever there were documents. But we can see that it stretches back at least to, say, the first or second century CE. And all the dates we're going to talk about tonight will be in the Common Era. Nothing that we know stretches into the BCE time periods. We have, for instance, an image of the Buddha, and of course this is already late because in the first several centuries after the Buddha's passing, there were no images of him. It only comes in a much later period. We see him seated and in his teaching position with a skull tapper on one side and one of the shramanas from his field on the other. And he seems to be in agreement with both. In other words, he's accepting both traditions. Well, the skull tapper is a proto-tantric, could even have been connected with a school called the Pashupatas, who followed Lakulisha. And Lakulisha was antinomian in the extreme. And what antinomian means is that this is a person who refuses to accept moral strictures because grace, because a moment of enlightenment, frees you from obligation to it. So the Pashupatas live outside normal society, even congregate in cremation grounds, carry with them a staff and a skull, a human skull, and go about practicing their doctrines away from public view, and so are spoken of ill by people who belong to polite society. And yet they have something that is living and dynamic to them. That early school of the Pashupatas later becomes the Kapalikas, those who carry the skulls. And those are definitely early tantrics. And of course, the association of Shiva with cremation grounds would lead you to think that, the early tantrics come from an early school of Shiva worshippers, of Shaivism. And that's not exactly true, because early tantrics also came from the worship of the Divine Mother, of the Mahashakti, the Mahadevi. As we saw last week, that was a constant in Indian spiritual life dating back to times immemorial, but had not been part of courtly life until rather late. So there are tantrics who are associated with the Shakti, and they are called Shaktas, those who worship the Shakti. There are also tantrics who are associated with Vishnu, The Pancharatra school is just such. And there are tantrics who are not associated with any. Indeed, what you can say about the tantrics is that they are non-sectarian. You can't pin them down to a particular school. The very idea of there being a tantric practice is something that the West discovered. Indians had no terminology for this because they may have been unorthodox. They may not have been Vedic. They were definitely seen as being non-Vedic. And they themselves, the tantrics, explicitly rejected lordship of the Vedas over their lives. But even so, they were part of the general stream. And you can find tantric elements in normal Hindu rituals. And you can find some elements of normal Hindu things in tantric rituals. You can find in the tantras exquisite Sanskrit. In fact, it seems to have been the way that the elite class of tantrics communicated with each other, was through quite extraordinary, perfected Sanskrit. But there were also tantric schools which did not use Sanskrit, which used the vernacular languages. And those schools were a little closer to normal Hindu practice. By now, of course, Hinduism is coming into its own. We're beginning to see the growth of bhakti religions, etc. We've moved long since away from the Vedic sacrifice and the Vedi, the altar upon which the sacrifice was made. And instead, there has come this great growth of temple building. A lot of wealth has gone into the construction of magnificent temples. Where did the Brahmins go who used to conduct the Vedic rituals? They became priests and came to the temples. They still had to earn a living. So the gist of Vedic life as it continues in the Vedantic stream and as it meets the proliferation of new gods and goddesses which are being worshipped in temples gives rise to what we would call Hinduism. But Tantra is something still behind that. And it seems to be a phenomenon that grows in the north, from Bengal, from Assam, into upper UP, into Kashmir, finally into Punjab and Rajasthan. And these great teachings are again different from the Hindu in that where Hinduism is public, where the ceremonies, where the pujas, the worship, is done openly in a temple and everybody participates. When we get to the Tantra, it is done privately. It is done in a ritualized way, apart from public notice. And there are many elements to the Tantra, but remember this central thing, that where Buddhism and Jainism and even much Brahmanical teaching is shramanic in nature, that means that if you want to live a true and deep and proper spiritual life, you leave the world behind, you renounce the world, you become a mendicant, and you wander. When we come to the Tantra has none of that. The Tantra says, no, you work for enlightenment, you work for liberation, and you work for worldly success and power also. You accept the world. And you see the world as an expression of the divine. You see the world as being carried within the divine. And who is this the divine? It can be seen as the Shakti, it can be seen as Shiva, but it fully permeates reality. And so as a practitioner of the Tantra, what you are trying to do is to experience that Godhead in yourself. And there are many elements that go into it, of course. There's Kriya, there's the action, the ritual that you have to undertake. There's the yoga, the effort, the tapasya that you have to apply to it. There's the yantra, the mandala, the visual forms which give body to this so that you can feel it. There's the mantra, the inner word that you learn how to recite, given to you by the teacher, so that you can make this thing spark and come alive. Set the mandala into motion, as it were. Make the yantra, which means engine, start to work. There is, of course, the shishya, the disciple. And the shishya has to have a certain kind of bearing, has to have improved himself to a minimal level to be able to warrant the teaching, because he's about to be introduced to the infinite. So he has to have a capacious being, something that can carry it, something that can hold the charge, something that can see the light and not be blinded, something that can transmit goodness, something that can enjoy without desire, something that can, in a sense, represent the divine upon earth. There has to be the teacher. The teacher is the one who transmits, who must already, himself or herself, live in this divine consciousness and transmit the power of the goddess or the power of the god so that it can be ignited in you and you can experience that. The mandala is symbolic of all that we're talking about because it's this circle. Like the mother's symbol is a mandala. And at the center is this point of light. It's a bindu. It is that from which the divine consciousness radiates. And the divine consciousness is reality. There is no question in tantric life but that the world is seen as real. It is not illusory, as in the field of Advaita Vedanta. It is not a world of suffering, as in the field of Buddhism. Instead, it is potentially full of delight. And the tantric should move out adventurously into the world, trying to taste the infinite in every drop of rasa, of sap, that comes his way. So, the seeker of the tantra has to be initiated properly, has to have the guru who represents the divine to him, has to see in the mandala the very figuring of the universe, because in a sense the mandala represents the world. It's an intermediary. It mediates between the divine transcendence and what we are inside. So when you see the mandala and the word is given to you to make that work, the ritual makes the mandala come alive, makes the yantra come alive, then you become identified with that central point. You become the center of the universe. And the mandala, of course, if you've seen the Sri Yantra, you know, is a mass of different triangles because there are many, many levels. And so if the mandala were seen from above, it would, in a sense, be you, with concentric circles leading down. At the top would be that thousand-petaled lotus, the Sahasrara, and then there would be the level of the Ajna Chakra, the command center, and then the Vishuddha, and then, you know, Anahata, and all the way down till it reaches the base of the Muladhara. And all of these different centers are planes of being that are cosmic, but they also exist in you. Some represent your mind, some represent your higher emotions, some represent your animal energies, some represent the sexual urge, the very basic instinct of life, to want to live, to want to reproduce, etc. And if you come to the center of yourself, then all of this is connected as if pearls on a strand. And so it's a transformative experience because now you live from inside out. There is no particular aim that you seek anymore because you live in the divine consciousness identified with the great Shakti, the Mahashakti, or with Lord Shiva, Maheshwara. And your experience of life is one of liberation, but also one of enjoyment. So there is both mukti and bhukti. Nothing is left out. The world is seen as power, is seen as an expression of delight. There are many schools of Tantra, and not just one. We begin to see tantric texts come into existence maybe around the 7th century. And some of this starts getting encoded in Sanskrit. We see some evidence of this epigraphically carved into temple walls as far back as 423 CE. But we probably have the greatest efflorescence of tantric teaching in Kashmir. And we're going to spend an entire week talking about Kashmiri Shaivism next time. And we're going to speak about their greatest exponent, Abhinavagupta, then, who was both a brilliant philosopher, ranking in the stratosphere with Shankara. At the same time, he was a wonderful aesthetician and poet. Beautiful, mellifluous in his use of Sanskrit, and thought of the divine as beauty expressed in the world. So we'll spend some time next week speaking about that great tradition. And then the week after that, we'll talk about the Sri Vidya, because the Sri Vidya, which is dominant in Southern tantric practice and continues to this day, finds its roots in Kashmiri Shaivism, but now, of course, is based in the South and is where we find Vedanta meeting tantric teaching and undergoing yet another synthesis. So there'll be that to speak about. More from the Kashmir Shaivism school comes the school of the Siddhas, those who are perfected, and the Nats, N-A-T-H, who stem from them. And of course, from the Natha Yogis come the Hatha Yogis. And so there's this entire lineage of tantric teaching that carries down to this time, but sort of as a tributary, not always understanding that its own origin is tantric, but nevertheless carrying that as what really gives it force and dynamism. We were talking about the Devi tradition last week. And she continues here in the worship of the Shakti. Much of the tantric discipline is devoted to her. The Sri Vidya that we'll come to look at centers itself upon the Devi. Sri, as in the goddess Sri, Lakshmi, representing prosperity and beauty, and Vidya, for knowledge, because she is the beauty who gives knowledge. One of the primary documents that's used in the worship of Sri Vidya is the Sri Lalita Sahasranama, the thousand names of the Divine Mother. This is a text, we don't really know how old it is. Bhaskara Raya Makin lived in the 18th century and wrote a wonderful commentary upon it around the year 1728. So we know it's earlier than that. It could be as early as the 9th century, but as I said last week, it could be as late as the 14th. We don't know. You can take your guess at that. But it is a means still today by which aspirants find their way into a felt communion with the divine goddess through the recitation of the mantra. And in that, one need not represent the whole of the stotra, the whole thousand names at one time. One can recite what one is comfortable with. You see, this is different than what we saw with Devi Mahatmyam, where you have to do all 700 verses. With Sri Lalita Sahasranam, you can recite the number of verses that you feel inclined to do, and if there is a particular aspect of the goddess that feels important and calls to you, then you may, in a sense, stick with that. But note this, that it begins with the description of the great goddess who comes out of the fire of consciousness. She is giving birth to the universe. She is the origining of the universe, transmits it into being from her own essence, from her own transcendence. She doesn't do this with the blessing of a god. She simply does it. She doesn't need Shiva to say, go do this, Shakti, and report to me later. She simply does it. And she sustains the universe and represents herself in many ways. The idea of a thousand names is meant to signify to us that it is infinite. It represents the infinite, like the thousand-petaled lotus opens us to the experience of the infinite. Any particular aspect, any particular goddess name can lead you into the experience of the all or into what is beyond the all, but through the world, so that when you experience that ascension into the infinite, when you rise in consciousness, when you stir awake that primal power, that kundalini force, and it rises through all the levels of your being and carries your awareness from the physical through the mental up into the infinite, you don't stay there. Rather, it is the movement of a cycle, and you return. There is a descent. An ascent, and then a descent. And what comes back is a transformed being. You've changed fundamentally. You're still in a body. You still get hungry at 6 o'clock in the evening. You still sleep for a number of hours every night. You still have a bodily human life. But the center of gravity has shifted for you. You no longer live primarily in the ego. The ego hangs around. But you are aware of this divine force in you, and it is a conscious force. It's not an abstracted Purusha who's divorced from the world, looking down upon it. No, this is the soul of the world looking through you out. Now, the idea of the Tantra is that this individual, so awakened and so enlightened, does not live alone, but develops a larger community. In fact, there is a strong and important school of tantric life. They're called the Kaulas, which means those who belong to a family, a kula. And there is an idea here of a society of enlightened beings, that those who share a spiritual path, perhaps they're all following a guru, are all moving in solidarity, marching in unison towards a common goal, with the idea that they will remake human life into a divine life, that they will shed ignorance and ego and live primarily from the divine consciousness, that they will be as God and Goddess upon earth, because ego has been supplanted by the experience of this larger reality. We become one with the cosmos and with that which expresses itself as the cosmos. Remember, the divine, whether seen as Shiva or seen as the Mahashakti, is the one conscious reality who is based in delight and who expresses itself effulgently, endlessly. So there's one step more in that not only should the individual gain enlightenment, and not only should the group carry forward in collective yoga, but there should be an enlightened society and ruler. Now, in the tantric scheme of things, just as there's the center to a mandala, there's the center to a society and a sovereign country, let's say. Whether that ruler is a woman or a man is immaterial, but there should be somebody who represents the goddess, somebody who represents the god at the center of all of life, making sure that the world is conducted according to the right rhythms of things. Now, this is very interesting. Remember, we began with an antinomian private practice, the Tantra, away from view of everything, and now here it is marching into center stage and saying this secret experience of soulhood should be made broad-based. Along the way, it's trampled all of society's norms. It's knocked over its iconography. It says, you don't need those images. What you need is the living experience of the divine. It said, you don't need these moral strictures. You don't need these shastras telling you what to do and when to do it. If you live in the consciousness of the Mahadevi, you will do things in the right rhythm at the right time at the auspicious order. You will make harmony come into being. Samarasya Parayana. Center of harmony in life. And it's an amazing thing that there have actually been some occasions in the life of India where a ruler was housed in these tantric teachings and was experienced enough in the practice and the sadhana, the discipline that takes you there, that he could have moments when, sitting on the throne, there was a complete identity with the divine, a recognition of the social life, moving around that as an expression of the divine, so that the whole circle was complete. Interesting thing. hardly attained now and then in human life, but continues to be an aspiration for us all. Now, you forgive me, you know Sri Aurobindo's teaching is essentially aiming at the same thing. And he says, late in the synthesis of yoga, we're aiming at the synthesis of the Tantra, but starting from the basis of the Vedanta. In other words, realize the oneness of Godhead first and then move through that. There was a reason he felt that. And we'll get to the imperfections of the tantric sadhana. Maybe not tonight, but soon. We'll talk about that. But with Sri Aurobindo, there is also the idea of a transformed society and a global expression of diversity and oneness, where every country and every person in every country has the freedom, not the compulsion, but the freedom to live in confluence with these streams of mystic communion that reveal to us our own selves, but also the self of country and the self of world, all as many-leveled expressions of a divine reality. So Sri Aurobindo never had the chance to read these tantric texts from Kashmir. But late in his life, when you heard about them, it piqued his interest and said to one of his scholarly disciples, if you write the book, I'll read it. Regrettably, the book was never written. That's one of the ironies of life, I guess. So, what Tantra is, I suppose, famous for in America these days is the idea of tantric sex. That through the practice of Tantra, you can improve your sex life. The ideal in the Tantra is quite a bit different from that, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that tonight. Maybe we'll spend more time on it next week or the week after that. The week after that would probably be better. But the idea that we confront the things which are troublesome in our nature and turn them into strengths is part of it. The other part of it is that, frankly, sex is not the impediment to the awakening of consciousness that those who renounce the world feel that it is. And the idea is not ever in the Tantra that one gives oneself to concupiscence, that one becomes, you know, just a lust machine, you know, but that sex made sacramental becomes itself an expression of the union of the two poles of existence, the spiritual and the material. And so, in a sense, transforms us and lifts us out of the sexual exchange so that it becomes something godlike or goddess-like, if you will. The Tantra that associates itself with the practice of these, of the inclusion of sex in its ritualization, probably comes from the Kapalikas, the skull bearers. But they're also called the path of the left hand. They call that Vama Marga, the left-handed way, the left-handed path. Vama also means woman. So in a way, this is what men have said is the woman's way to liberation. As has been said about this, it's dubious to see what particular advantage there is for the woman in this practice, because over the centuries, this practice fell into disuse and possibly into misuse. We can't really say. Know why? Because when the British came to India in the 19th century and sort of took over life and started looking into the religious tenets and practices of the Indian peoples, they discovered, to their Victorian horror, that these people, these Indians, were experiencing life as it was, and they objected to it. So now, upper class educated Indians, who were embarrassed to have been so discovered, wanted nothing to do with it. Oh, no, it was never about that. These were ideas that we internalized. We never actually practiced those things. Nobody actually did that. The heck they didn't. They certainly did. But from a different basis, with a different goal. It wasn't simply to experience licentiousness in life, but to challenge you. Can you be really aware of the Godhead even when you're doing this? And this wasn't the most scary thing in the world, to have sex with somebody, whoever that person was, whether it was a lower caste woman or your own sister or somebody in menstruation. But often there were times where the Kapalikas would have ceremonies in the graveyard, and you could not really attain liberation until you lit a fire in the mouth of a corpse and sat there and conducted a complete ritual sitting upon the corpse. So you talk about confronting your fears, confronting death, confronting things which are to you abominations. Whatever it is that scares you, the Tantra is going to say, okay, bring that to me. I'm going to show you how you can turn this into a strength. I'm going to get you through a difficult experience, and on the other side of it, you'll see that it's not horrible. Now, wonder of wonders, when you go to Tibetan Buddhism, which is strongly based in Buddhistic tantric practice, there you are made to confront the demons straight away there. Have you ever seen these mandalas that the Tibetans have created, where you have to see the wrathful deity, and you have to not only make the mandala, but you have to experience that wrathful deity at the center of it? And if you do, it is transformed, and you experience grace, and you see the beauty behind it. And the same thing is true when you take even Hebrew teachings. Job, for instance, the book of Job, where you have to see the enormity of God, and there's this unreasoning torture and penance that is thrown upon this guy, and at the end you're staggered and you see that with your mind you can't understand that this thing is beyond good and evil. And a great spiritual experience takes you beyond the good and evil into what is antinomian. You no longer need to live by human codes of restraint and conduct, because you live divinely. It's not that you will hurt, that you will be at liberty to do any bit of damage you want, but you will feel solidarity with all the world. You will feel commonalty with all. You will feel one with all. So whether it's a vegetable or an animal or a fellow human being or a god or a goddess, you will have kindness in your heart and compassion, and you will act as you must because the divine force in you says you must. But you will never do it from idea of personal license. So, in this way, the Tantra uses the so-called five M's the things that you're not allowed to touch to carry you beyond into the transcendence. Bring me what you're afraid of, it says, and I'll turn it into a heroic strength for you. And this is the idea of the Tantra, that whatever craven mass of fear you might be when you come to practice this kind of yoga, this yogic sadhana will turn you into something heroic. You will exceed your being. You will live divinely, and you will live in communion with the Supreme. So, you may have a question or two.